Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
For the second day in a row, a big merger leads the business news. That is usually a promising economic sign. Also today, an Olympic story that's more red ink than gold, silver, or bronze. And the economics of style. It's Fashion Week in New York City. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the new Harvard Business Review, a source of smart thinking for today's business world. The revival of smart begins at hbr.org. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Wednesday, the 17th of February today, and it's good to have you here. Consider for a moment the old-time corner drugstore. Now, put that image completely out of your head, because in most parts of the country, drugstores are that, drugstores, plus a supermarket and a card shop and maybe a variety store thrown in for good measure. Today, Walgreens, the biggest drugstore chain out there by number of stores, said it's buying Duane Reade. That's a local chain that completely dominates the New York City market. Marketplace's Lisa Roth reports now on how those stores make money when there are just so many of them.
I'm standing in front of our bureau in Manhattan, and I'm counting drugstores. There's one a block to the east of me. There's another one a block to the west. There's one three blocks downtown, and then another one on the next corner. Jeff Jonas follows drugstores at Gabelli & Company. An asset management firm. He says New York needs them.
Because you have so many fewer grocery stores and other big box retailers, a lot of New Yorkers buy the majority of their goods at a drugstore.
And people in urban areas tend to shop close to home, because who wants to push their way onto the subway with 25 rolls of paper towels? Duane Reade is one of the biggest players in the New York metro area. It has more than 250 stores here. Walgreens only has 70. So this acquisition is an easy way for Walgreens to break into the New York market and to take advantage of what Jonas calls Duane Reade's expertise in urban retailing. The chain has the highest sales per square foot in the country. But there's no secret to the way Duane Reade makes money. John Long is a retail strategist at Kurt Salmon Associates. He says, like all drugstores, Duane Reade catches customers when they come in for prescriptions.
They get a tremendous amount of add-ons as people head back to the pharmaceutical counter to pick up their prescriptions or drop one off. They are passing by a whole host of other products that are offered.
And he says it doesn't matter if there's a store on every corner. All the drugstore companies have been trying to build their inventories locally, which means that store over on Lex probably has something different than the one on 2nd. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
All right, so if you want tighter rules for the financial industry, that's all well and good. But J.P. Morgan Chase said today that's going to bring a much higher cost of doing business, and it is not going to be the one that's paying. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
Right now, J.P. Morgan says the industry aims to make shareholders a return of better than 13%, but if every regulatory reform now proposed were implemented, the bank says it would cut that by more than half. Peter Cohen heads a management consulting and venture capital firm. He says J.P. Morgan and the rest of the financial industry need to accept it's a new world.
If you look at the industry over the last 5 years, the average return is 10%. J.P. Morgan's average return over the last 5 years was 8%. I think that it really depends on the individual firm, but I think 8% is a fair return for J.P. Morgan.
J.P. Morgan is warning the cost of banking services could jump by 33%, but Cohen says that's aimed at riling up customers and heading off regulators.
They're obviously trying to keep from having to pay out any more money that wouldn't go into their pockets as a bonus. So naturally, they want to either stop it altogether or, if it does have to happen, get their customers to pay for it. Heaven forbid that they should pay the price for all the pain they cause the rest of society.
Cohen says those bonuses amount to nearly half J.P. Morgan's revenue, and paying out less could help defray a lot of the cost. But the bank's report argues it wouldn't come close. Jason Paez is an investment banker at New York-based Bellstone Capital. He says free market competition should force these banks to share in the higher cost of regulation.
I think we've paid a price, and the direct cost, if we allow a repeat of 2008 to occur, is vastly dwarfing anything that we're talking about in the context of this particular J.P. Morgan report.
Paez suggests it's cheaper in the long run to pay the price of regulation and a safer financial system. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
The Treasury Department said today the January budget deficit tipped the scales at $42.5 billion. Bad, but not as bad as everybody was thinking. The current political dynamic in Washington, though, means nobody's real eager to take a stand on bringing that deficit down. Last month, the Senate put the kibosh on a bipartisan budget commission. So tomorrow, President Obama is going to create one all by himself. But that still doesn't mean he can make everybody play nice. Brett Neely reports.
The president's commission has Washington budget watchers feeling...
Yeah, muted, I guess, would be the best way to put it.
Michael Linden with the Liberal Center for American Progress says at best, the commission might educate the public about the deficit.
The budget is complicated. These issues are complex. And there's a lot of misunderstandings, misinformation about the federal budget.
Those misunderstandings make it hard to have an honest debate, says Maya McGinnis. She heads the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget.
The problem is that every part of the budget has become the third rail to somebody.
The commission's report could serve as the basis for a gentleman's agreement between both parties, says Joe Minerick of the Nonpartisan Committee for Economic Development. But
you have to wonder at this point and in this environment, A, whether you can get a gentleman's agreement, and B, whether you're dealing with gentlemen, whether the agreement will be honored.
Minerick says if a dysfunctional Congress can't get debt under control, expect financial crisis 2.0. In Washington, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
Traders eked out a win on Wall Street today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Even as he gets ready to name that commission on the budget deficit, President Obama was celebrating the first anniversary of his economic stimulus program today. But right on the heels of telling us how many jobs have been saved or created, the president was warning about layoffs to come as stimulus money that states are getting runs out. Layoffs are already the reality in Colorado Springs, Colorado. The state constitution there makes it pretty hard to raise taxes. So instead, city officials have found some attention-getting ways to cut spending. From Colorado Public Radio, Zachary Barr has more.
Renee Bergen fixes street lamps for a living. So for her, the irony of today's job is clear.
It's opposite of what I usually do, but usually I'm supposed to keep the lights on, you know.
Bergen climbs aboard a white bucket truck and is hoisted up into the air. She's set to disable a working street light.
We will swap out the sensor and put orange marker tape.
The orange tape signifies the lights turned off, and over the next few months, crews will repeat this task 10,000 times. City officials believe the savings will total over $1 million a year. But that's not enough to plug a $28 million funding gap. So other cuts include night and weekend bus service and a police helicopter unit. Additionally, the city now has 15% fewer employees than 2 years ago. That's according to city manager Penny Colbreth Graft.
We have a significant long-term financial issue that is basically a product of our desire to keep services going without a revenue stream to pay for those services.
That revenue stream is taxes, and taxes in Colorado Springs are a lot smaller than in other cities its size. The city's 400,000 residents are politically conservative with a well-known anti-tax streak, and they've got a powerful state law on their side. Colorado's Taxpayers' Bill of Rights means
municipalities do not have the ability to raise taxes without the vote of the people.
Jan Martin's on city council. She introduced a large property tax hike on last November's ballot. It was specifically designed to offset the funding gap. Residents overwhelmingly rejected the tax increase. Businessman Chuck Fowler was one of those anti-tax voters.
Governments have a tendency to grow and get big and take on things that many believe they shouldn't be taking on. And that's the case here, and that's the case everywhere.
Fowler heads a business group critical of how the city's handling its budget. He believes city officials are ignoring the obvious.
They're going for the things that are easy to cut rather than the things that are hard to cut. And the things that are hard to cut deal with human beings and personnel.
Fowler says the city needs to look much harder at pay cuts and layoffs. But city officials have decided that its employees shouldn't take pay cuts just because residents want to keep taxes low. So instead, Parks and Recreation took a big hit. That department's budget was recently slashed by 75%. In more than 100 city parks, you'll no longer see a trash can. The grass may grow brown because there's no money to water. Bathrooms are locked shut, and pools and rec centers are set to be closed. Dean Hightower and his dog are regular visitors to the city's largest park.
There's a lot of people in Colorado Springs that really rely on being able to come to the park and have a good time. But, you know, the budget shortfalls that we've got right now is just killing everybody. I mean, look at our roads.
Speaking of roads, the city's cut its paving unit to zero for budgetary reasons. In Colorado Springs, I'm Zachary Barr for Marketplace.
Along with much of the rest of the retail world, fashion has taken a beating the past couple of years. But when you talk fashion, there are really two markets, the one most of us shop in, the off-the-rack regular retail stuff. And then the high-end, the world of big-name designers and runway models. Both have been hit by a down economy. But still, the show must go on. The fashion show, that is. This week is Fashion Week in New York City. The runways have been set up in Bryant Park behind the New York Public Library, where we ask some people how they're feeling about fashion right now.
I would say overall for Fashion Week this year, I would actually wear a lot of things. And I'm not a fashion forward kind of person. It just seems like it would go right from runway to like the sales rack.
I think we've all accepted the downturn and we want to look more fabulous. You know, like, all right, I don't have any money in my pocket, but I'm sparkling on the outside.
That was Nicole Brinkley and Ann Daniello in Bryant Park this morning. Ray Smith covers fashion for the Wall Street Journal. Ray, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So here we are, two-something years after the recession started. How is the design world feeling about things, about its consumers, about the market in general?
They're feeling cautiously optimistic. They are very aware that consumers still have reservations about spending a lot of money, and designers are treading carefully in terms of wanting to offer something new and exciting, but not going too far, not being too tricky. They're playing it almost safe in a way. And also, some designers are actually responding by expanding the range of products that they make so that there's more affordable pieces in there. And we also saw a broader use of materials like wool, for instance. I know that seems kind of, well, wool is sort of every day, but as opposed to as much cashmere is the point that I'm trying to make.
It's all relative, right? Wool versus cashmere?
Certainly is, but we did see a lot more of that wool. We did see a lot more sportswear, if you will. And that's a big change also, because the runways used to be just limited to very sort of almost artistic designs that may or may not even make it into stores, but were supposed to wow fashion editors and Anna Wintour and the like.
Is that to say that fashion editors and Anna Wintour have less influence now that designers are being more, can we say, cost conscious?
I think they still have an outsized influence, but I think the problem is that designers and retailers are realizing that that doesn't sell, and ultimately you have to make money, and this is a business. And so they still have their influence, and don't get me wrong, designers are still making their artistic statements, but they're rounding it out a lot more with commercial and accessible pieces.
I heard you talking to my producer before we really got going about one of the only people in fashion that I know, Michael Kors, from the guy from Project Runway, and what he's doing and how his looks are changing. Tell us about that.
Sure. Michael Kors has always been very polished and about, you know, super high-end looks for the jet setter, and he's still doing that. I mean, today in his runway show, which is one of the biggest shows of New York Fashion Week, he did show a lot of fur. But what was different this time was a lot more distressed looks. I think it's just a sign of the times that the distressing is sort of like toning down that sort of luxe factor, if you will, And by distressing, I mean like things were washed or pre-washed, or there were things like crushed velvet or things that were made to look sort of worn in.
Yeah, I can get that in my Levi's 501s, right? I mean,
so there certainly is a nod to having to show looks that are a little more understated.
It sounds a little bit like these designers are trying to have a foot in both worlds. They want the high end, they want the looks, but they also want the affordability. Is that the way it's going to be for a while until things really sort of turn around in the economy?
Yes. The catchword for what's happened over the past year and a half, 2 years is value. And value, not just in terms of lower prices, but meaning that luxury consumers will get more bang for the buck. Mm-hmm. That's a challenge for all the designers right now to sort of meet somewhere in the middle where there's enough commerciality to appeal to retailers, obviously, who want to sell the stuff. But there's also just a little bit of either flair or artsiness that is going to wow the Vogue editors.
Ray Smith, he's a style reporter for The Wall Street Journal, covering New York Fashion Week at Bryant Park this week. Ray, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, an honest day's work as disaster relief in Haiti.
There are meaningful long-term jobs in the construction sector that have very few qualified people to fill. And so we've got to address that.
But first, we've got to do the numbers. Dow Industrials lifted 40 points today, 0.4%, closed at 10,309, the blue chips did. The NASDAQ climbed 12 points, 0.5%, finished at 2226. The S&P 500 added 4 points, 0.4%, landed at 1,099. Investors developed a strong appetite for Whole Foods a day after the grocery chain boasted its outlook for the year. The stock rang up a 12% gain today. Better-than-expected profit report from John Deere pushed the stock up 5%. Caterpillar shares went along for the ride. They climbed more than 0.5% today. Bond prices declined, though. That nudged the yield on the 10-year Treasury note up to 3.73%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done. You can build a team online at elance.com.
And by the Henry Luce Foundation, seeking to increase American understanding of East and Southeast Asia. What does setting interest rates have in common with driving a car? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In New York, the Conference Board publishes its monthly index of leading economic indicators. In Washington, the Labor Department releases producer price index data for January. And President Obama is scheduled to meet with the Dalai Lama in the MAP room at the White House. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal, and because I am such a good guy, I am not going to tell you what I know about who won what in Olympic ski racing today. Even though I read it on the news wires earlier, I am firmly in the camp of not wrecking anybody else's tape-delayed viewing pleasure. But on the very hill that the downhill events are being run, there is a new Olympic event making its debut this week. It's called Foreclosure. The group that owns the Whistler Blackcomb Ski Resort has fallen behind on its payments, and creditors say they are going to foreclose smack dab in the middle of the games. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
The Vancouver Olympics have been dubbed the Glitch Games. There were problems with an Olympic cauldron during the opening ceremony. Things went downhill from there with bad weather and postponed events. Now this.
We missed a payment.
That's Dan Mudd, the CEO of Fortress Investments, speaking on CNBC. Fortress is a hedge fund that bought Whistler Blackcomb in 2006. It borrowed a lot of money. Creditors weren't happy when Fortress missed a debt payment in December. They say they'll foreclose on Friday. Mudd says negotiations are underway to avoid that.
Everybody's at the table. Everybody's talking. Sometimes the voices are louder. Sometimes they're quieter. We're working to get there.
If they don't get there, could Whistler Blackcomb be on the auction block on Friday? Would the Olympics be disrupted? Jonathan Basile doesn't think so. He's an economist at Credit Suisse.
If it's going into foreclosure, maybe it's in this first pre-foreclosure process and not necessarily further along where they're going to take the keys from everybody and lock them out.
Why is Fortress Investments so close to losing the keys? Karen Petru is with Federal Financial Analytics. She says Fortress built a bunch of swanky slopeside condos at Whistler just before the bottom fell out of the housing market. People who had planned to take out a home equity loan to buy a second home at Whistler had to change their plans.
The first homes had been ATMs for seconds, and the money just fell out of the machine,
leaving Fortress Investments with a mountain of debt. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
There was the faintest glimmer of hope in European financial circles today. Investors snapped up a new Spanish government bond that went on sale this morning. Part of that is because Madrid offered a pretty high interest rate. They had to, given the debt squeeze that's going on over there right now. But part of it could be because some of the worries about actual government defaults have dissipated. Commentator David Frum figures President Obama ought to be paying pretty close attention.
Last week, the government of Spain announced big cuts in government spending, $70 billion over the next 3 years. Allowing for the difference in size between the American and Spanish economies, that's almost an Obama stimulus in reverse. The Spanish package contains a lot of gimmicks, but pensions will be cut, job creation schemes halted, and the retirement age raised to 67. Ireland has swallowed even harsher medicine. Portugal, Greece, and probably Italy will soon follow. These countries are cutting deficits in the throes of the worst recession since World War II. They are making these choices because they perceive the alternative as worse, a risk that budget deficits will create market pressures that will force them off the euro. These governments and others in Europe are accepting higher unemployment in order to defend their currency. That's the policy choice that got Herbert Hoover such a bad name. Back then, the currency was the gold standard dollar, but the principle is the same. And yet, while Spain's socialist government has seen its poll numbers drop, neither Spain, nor Greece, nor Portugal, nor Ireland is experiencing serious public pressure to quit the euro. To the leaders of these countries, the euro means Europe, and Europe means prosperity, stability, democracy, and peace. The leaders of virtually all major parties made this argument to voters, and the voters have accepted it. Populism is seldom as popular as pundits imagine. Protectionism may do well in the polls, but it's the free traders who win the elections. If leaders want to summon voters to look past the difficulties of the moment, they have to make that case forcefully and unapologetically. When President Obama said in his State of the Union address, "We all hated the bank bailout," he made his own job vastly more difficult. If you are going to defend something tough, then defend it. Events will prove you right or wrong, and in the latter case, there will be an eternity in which to express regret.
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Defend your thoughts. You can write to us at marketplace.org. Just click on that link that says contact. The president of France took a tour of Port-au-Prince today. Nicolas Sarkozy said afterward that the French government is giving Haiti $400 million in disaster relief. It'll help pay for reconstruction and emergency assistance. But there are a lot of ways assistance money gets spent on the ground. It goes for food and water and medical care and sometimes jobs. From Port-au-Prince, Sabri Benachour explains.
In the courtyard of one Port-au-Prince primary school, there's a small, secluded tent city. Jean Romand lives there under a sheet and a few sticks. Using a very worn-looking shovel, he's scooping away rubble. You have to clean up where you live, he says. He's been working since 6 a.m. So is Daniel Milo. A lot of people want this job, she says. I'm happy to have it, but I have so many problems. My house is gone, my kids are sick. It's not enough, but it's better than nothing. Milo and Rimmel and a couple hundred other people have this job thanks to Mercy Corps, a Maryland-based aid organization.
The idea really is to get money into people's pockets.
Carol Ward is running this pilot project. It's a type of foreign aid called cash for work, and it's just that. People get cash for doing some kind of useful work, like clearing rubble or a little bit later on, actually rebuilding buildings.
And they're working their hearts out, bless them.
Haiti's unemployment rate was already above 50% before the earthquake, so the demand for work is staggering. Bill Holbrook is the Haiti country director for Mercy Corps.
You can show up on any street corner in any spontaneous settlement, and you'll find a very, very long line of individuals, survivors, who are anxious to go to work.
But cash for work is also about training.
There is a very large and unacceptable percentage of people who are unemployable. They don't have job skills that are marketable.
Construction is where the training will start, says Holbrook, given the immense rebuilding task ahead in Haiti.
There are meaningful long-term jobs in the construction sector that have very few qualified people to fill. And so we've got to address that.
The World Food Program recently announced it was going to launch cash for work type programs as well. They'd hire about 100,000 people. Manuel Orozco is an economist with the Inter-American Development Bank.
Cash for work, I think, is just very important in Haiti because of the large unemployment rate.
It has to be sustained over a couple of years, Orozco says, so workers gain different skills.
So that when the program ends, they can actually be absorbed by the private sector. It does have a positive impact.
Orozco is adamant about that last part, transitioning to the private sector. If NGOs don't pay attention, they could put the local construction industry out of business down the road.
If you make it a widespread process, it will have distortions into the national markets because it does compete with the demand for local labor.
For now, the goal is to get people back on their feet. And back at the primary school tent settlement, Antoinette Nesto hopes it will do just that. This is a good job for me, she says, but I used to be in business. I'd buy and sell at the market. Then I lost all my merchandise in the earthquake. For now, she'll keep sweeping rubble. Maybe, she says, she'll make a little bit of money in the hope of one day starting up her business again. From Port-au-Prince, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. ConstantContact.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, today you can mark Friday as the day professional golf gets its groove back, and the PGA hopes its revenue, too. Tiger Woods, hold on to your hats, folks, is going to speak, not taking any questions, though. Interestingly, it's going to happen while the Accenture Match Play Championship is going on out in Arizona, thus sucking all the life from that event. Accenture, as it so happens, was the first sponsor that dropped Woods back a couple of months ago. And on that note, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 40 points, about 0.4%. The NASDAQ ticked up 12 points, 0.5%. The S&P 500 added 4 points. That is 0.4%. Coming up next time on the broadcast, the fight over the teachers' union here in Los Angeles.
When we win, then the world will say that we can do a far better job than a private school or a charter school or an education management company.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.